You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel. And believe it or not, this is episode 168. Been doing this for about 6 years now, and it just keeps getting better. We're blessed and honored to have a repeat guest, someone who's become a close friend of mine and a colleague. His name is Jose Botello. Jose, are you there?
Yes, I am here. Thank you for having me, Dr. Gold.
Oh, God bless you. Thank you for coming on board. Jose is now living not far from where I live here in Bakersfield, and he's comes from an interesting background, and I'll give him a chance to perhaps do a short autobiographical portrait about his early life and what he's doing now. Jose, it's all yours.
Thank you, Dr. Gold. Well, let's see, where do I start? Well, I was born in a really small pueblo nestled in the middle of the jungle in Nayarit, Mexico. And that is a west central coastal state. And my small pueblo, it's named Mazatlan. It's an indigenous pueblo. I believe the Spanish got there, set up their Catholic temple around the mid-1700s, but my family, my roots go way before that. I was granted access to those baptismal records of that temple, and I found some of my family members, my great-great-grandfather, who was listed there in the baptismal records, you know, obviously his name there in those documents, and also in parentheses stating that he was an indigenous person of that land.
Jose, would it be proper to, in Euro-American slang, to call your ancestors Aztec or Nahua? What would you call them?
In that particular area of where my village is now, the people there called themselves the Tekoshkin. Okay. And they were a Nahuatl-speaking nation, yes.
Okay. And so they must have lived there for hundreds, thousands of years.
Oh, since time immemorial, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Okay, please,
yes.
Continue.
So after, you know, looking into these records, I was amazed. It's something that I've always knew. My family's always known. We've been really, we honored and proud of our roots, of our ancestral indigenous roots of that land. So I've always grown up hearing stories of my grandfather, my father, who is now in the spirit realm now with the ancestors. He passed when I was around two. But I grew up on stories of them, of just all that ecological knowledge that they held, of learning how to use plants for healing, learning how to plant and sow seeds during these different cycles of nature. So it's just been an honor to have grown up and still have a part of my indigenous ancestry intact. And it's been quite a journey so far, diving as deep as I can go.
Jose, was the economy there in your pueblo at all agricultural, or was that, did they plant and harvest native foods?
They did. One of the, obviously the main one would be corn, but right now, and they're still, it's one of their main cash crops is coffee.
Okay.
The native coffee plants, that's still going, it's very relevant still to this day. A lot of livestock as well, native indigenous livestock like turkeys, were really held in high regard. That's my 5-month-old trying to chime into the conversation.
God bless him.
Yes. So yeah, a lot of turkeys, quail, and other critters that were used as a food staple, but also as for ceremonial and ritual uses.
Now, you were active in certain areas religiously and ceremonially, weren't you, there at your pueblo?
Yes, for the most part. A lot of these practices have really, to use one of your famous terms, interfingered with Catholic practices.
Sure.
In this beautiful dance of syncretism that my ancestors used to survive. You know, when the Spanish got there, they really outlawed a lot of their practices. So they hid a lot of these ceremonies and rituals behind some Catholic ceremony and ritual.
So you had a church right there in your pueblo, because you alluded to that.
Yes, there is a Catholic temple that is still to this day used, which was erected in the 1700s. But from what I've been told from a local historian is that date, it's actually outside of the temple, and it says 1735. But historian said that temple was built a lot earlier. That 1735 date was just, there was a natural disaster which kind of put this temple in ruin. And that 1735 date was when it was re-erected.
Ah, I see.
Mm-hmm. So I also have some ancestry. I have an aunt that is actually buried in the San Juan Bautista Mission near Hollister. And this is a part of my ancestry, of my lineage that I'm still trying to reconnect.
That's Hollister in California?
Yes, in California.
Oh, wow. Mm. Amazing.
Yes. And from the record, baptismal records there from that mission, San Juan Bautista Mission, she was identified as Ama Mutsen Ohlone.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Understood. Mm-hmm. So did you attend the Catholic Church? And then also the Catholic Church was heavily involved with sort of this, as you call it, syncretic or interfingered native religion and Catholicism. Maybe give us a bit of a picture about that, please.
Yes. So I did, especially in my younger days, I did attend a lot of those ceremonies that they hold there today, especially a lot of the funerary rites that they hold there. It's very Catholic heavy. But as a kid, you know, I was mostly there because I had to be there. Now I have a great respect towards the people that practice the Catholic rituals and ceremonies there. So now, at my own accord, I mostly practice the old ways of my ancestors.
Now, when you were living in that pueblo, did you speak Spanish or Nahuatl?
We spoke Spanish mostly. I was told by my grandma that her grandma were Nahuatl speaking.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so since that time, you have been under tutelage, learning the old ways, and I guess also learning somewhat about the Nahuatl language, correct?
Correct, which is very interesting because a lot of the words that we use, that my family uses, which were lost in time, and they grew up thinking, you know, it was Spanish, but it wasn't Spanish. Those are Nahuatl words.
Can you give us an example or two or no?
Of course, there's a lots of examples. This goes for many Spanish-speaking peoples of Mexico from different parts. Okay. They don't know that, you know, that they're speaking Nahuatl. So let's see, there's a lot of examples I can use, like the word aguacate.
That's Nahuatl word. Aguacate.
Yeah, even the word for turkey, guajolote, that's a Nahuatl word. There's many words. Yes. So it's actually very interesting that, you know, little do they know, they are speaking and using Nahuatl.
That's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. Now, I guess fast forward, how did you get from your pueblo to California?
My siblings, they migrated here first. My mother, she was 52 years old when she gave birth to me.
Okay.
So my brothers and sisters are a lot older than me. So I was born in my pueblo due to certain medical factors that were dealt to me. I was granted the ability to migrate here to California in search of medical help, which I'm very grateful for. But that's, to make a long story short, that's sure. How I ended up here in California.
And what year was that when you may have come to California?
That must have been in 1992.
Okay, so not that long ago, really.
Not that long ago, no.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh. So we met when I was a teacher at Cal State University Bakersfield where I guess you went to school originally, right?
Yes, that's where I did my undergraduate work.
Right. And was your major anthropology?
My major was in anthropology. I received my bachelor's in anthropology there at California State Bakersfield. Then
Why did you choose anthropology? I got to ask that question.
Oh, I mean, what's better than studying your own culture? You know?
Absolutely.
It didn't even feel like a job to me. It's something that I already did. It's my life. I don't consider it an extracurricular activity. It's just the life that I live.
Yeah, so you had a chance of using your own background as the subject matter for your studies.
Exactly.
Fantastic. Great. Yeah. So you got a bachelor's degree there. You were my student assistant.
Yes, those were.
And then what caused you to migrate to, I understand you did your graduate work elsewhere, didn't you?
Yes, I then transferred to California State Northridge. It was interesting the way I ended up there. I believe it was during the beginning of COVID when I finished my bachelor work, and I had other plans to, I really wanted to attend UC Santa Barbara, but because of COVID, that didn't end up happening. So one of the few programs that still kept their doors open during those hard times was Cal State Northridge. So,
I see.
Yes. So it was, you know, I like to think that everything happens for a reason, and I am honored and I am really happy to have done my graduate work there. So it was an amazing time.
Well, let's leave it there. We'll call that the first segment, and then we'll pick it up on the other side. See you in the flip-flop, gang.
Welcome back, gang. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel on your Rock Art podcast. And we're blessed and honored to have Jose Botello, who's sharing his autobiographical portrait and talking a little bit about his culture, his language, and the nature of even religious observation and linguistics. Probably offline or even on the show, I think I asked him a bit about the language that he used when he was there in his pueblo, and he said he spoke Spanish, but now he is becoming quite familiar with the ancient language of his ancestors, and it's called Nahuatl. Jose, it's all yours. Talk a bit about that, if you would.
So this goes really hand in hand with what I did for my thesis, because for my thesis, what ended up being was a autoethnography. Just a little short backstory about that process. My initial thesis, which was already approved with the IRB, the Institutional Review Board, everything was ready to go. My initial thesis project was to be an ethnobotanical monograph of the Kern Canyon, the Kern River, or that, you know, general area. I was going to record and actually add to the literature that's out there on all the ethnobotany and all tribes here, the peoples here, and the way that they used these natural medicines or foods or any use of plants. So that was my initial thesis project. I was very ambitious, to say the least. I found it very difficult, the logistics to interview all these elders. It would have taken me a very long time to finish this project. And it's still a project that I want to one day conclude, but I was faced with that dilemma. I was getting stressed. I was kind of running out of time. I really wanted to finish my thesis in a timely manner.
For some of us that are maybe not familiar, Bakersfield is kind of in the southern end of the Central Valley of California. And just off to our east is the mouth of the Kern River. And that runs all across the Sierras up into the Kern Plateau. And there's several different Indian groups that are connected and situated in this area, several. And the need for them would be rather complex. There's a lot of botanicals, a lot of plants. There's still a lot of natural plants, native plants, littered throughout the canyon and into the uplands. Mm-hmm. And they were used extensively for medicine, but also for food and for other purposes as well. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, Jose, I also had an ambitious project to do an ethnobotanical study mm-hmm. with one of the native people. But unfortunately, she passed away before mm-hmm. I could really do that. But it's certainly, you know, an ambitious project, but it would be a lot of fun to do nonetheless. Oh. It's the area we're talking about is still, for the most part, greatly natural. Oh. It hasn't been built up or developed. So the Kern River Canyon and even up into the Kern Plateau is not heavily industrialized. Am I correct, Jose?
Oh, yeah. I just got home from there a few minutes ago. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where were you up there?
We were past, there's a spot that me and my family like to go and leave our offerings. It's a turnoff called China Gardens.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know that. Yeah. No, at least I know the name. Yes, I've heard mm-hmm. of it.
Yes.
Yeah. Is mm-hmm. it in the mountains or no?
It is in the mountains, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's maybe a 40, 45 minute drive from here.
Okay. Okay.
From where I live. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, so to continue your story, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, thank you for that.
So you had a problem and you finally hit it and you said, you know what? This is too complex. It'll take too long and it's too labor intensive. What the heck am I going to do, right?
Exactly. I had to be honest with myself. Struggling for a bit, and my wonderful fiance, one day she told me, why don't you propose a different project to your thesis committee? And why don't you write about yourself and your experiences and ceremony and ritual? And I just looked at her like, what? I can't believe I never thought about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was, as soon as I proposed this new project, my committee pretty much instantly approved. And I got to work.
So this is, you know, I've had a bachelor's, a master's, a PhD, and I've never heard of this autobiographical ethnography kind of a project for a thesis. So I guess I think you need to explain it, define it, first of all, and kind of explain what that is. Would you please?
Yes. So at the very basic, it is a very detailed description of one's experiences through your own perspective, while also adding in theoretical frameworks of existing literature. And from what I've been reading and researching, and what really stood out to me during my coursework at Northridge, was that this way of thinking was really encouraged, not just being the focus point of research, but also being, it's like you're studying yourself.
So you're using on two uh-huh. levels. There's some anthropological terms, emic and edic. So both, yes. you're a person who's of that culture and doing that culture, exactly. And you have a cognitive map of that particular universe. But you're also stepping above that culture and looking at it from, let's say, a scientific or anthropological standpoint, and examining it in a objective, independent, somewhat different way. Am I okay?
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Good. Thank you for that. And I really feel that this is a great direction that anthropology is taking, because it is allowing our people to voice our own stories. Like now we're getting recognized as, you know, oh, this is actually real knowledge. These are not just stories and myths, and we are being validated now. And it's an amazing route that anthropology has taken, I believe, personally.
So this is like being indigenous consultants, Native American observers themselves, and this interior domain knowledge is now being shared in a much more authentic and transparent way.
How's exactly that? Exactly.
Yeah. So you did that for your thesis, mm-hmm. but what was the subject of the thesis?
So my thesis touched on my experiences in sweat lodge ceremonies. Mm-hmm. In ritual dance. mm-hmm. and in gathering with traditional elders.
Perfect.
So ever since I really sent my roots down deep into my culture many years ago, I don't know, I wasn't even a teenager yet when I decided to fully embrace my traditional ways. From then on, I really have these vivid experiences of all these ceremonies, all these rituals that I attended. And, you know, obviously through permission of my elders, I was allowed to share these experiences and write about them for my thesis. Yes.
Wonderful. Absolutely great. So you did your thesis. You got it approved. And then what's happened since that time or during that time for you to begin to explore more about your ancestry, your religious background? I guess I would call it a deeper understanding of the Nahua culture.
Well, it really opened up that door of self-expression. It's really allowed me to really use both ways of thinking now. Before, I would go into these ceremonies and rituals strictly as an indigenous person. But now I just have, in the back of my mind, I just kind of analyze things a little bit further now. And it's really, you know, that there's no way out of that rabbit hole for me anymore.
You've got two sides of the coin that you're living in both worlds.
Exactly. Right? And I am combining both worlds.
Now, I asked you to do something that was very interesting recently, and I compensated you generously for it. What was it that I asked you to do with the magnum opus?
Oh, yes. So there was this project that Dr. Gold has been working on with a lot of the cosmology of the Eastern Sierra's Great Basin Coastal area. And there have been attempts of making comparisons between cosmologies of that area and the Nahua cosmology. So,
and the reason for that is because, of course, when they reconstruct or classify or geographically, spatially, try to understand a bit more linguistically, it seems very likely that the ancient Coso people were speaking a northern Uto-Aztecan language. And of course, that Uto-Aztecan language, that umbrella, is also part of the Nahua classification. Am I correct?
Yes. Yes, Ray. And what I did, what I offered for this project was, in a way, interpreting and really explaining and describing the way that my ancestral symbols portray, represent, exhibit these, what's the word I would use?
The concepts, the functions, the attributes.
The concepts.
And what did I learn from this? Well, what Jose taught me was basically the Western Cartesian way of thinking emphasizes classification and typology, putting things in boxes and giving them names. But what Jose was interested in and what his ancestors were interested in is not the boxes or not the classification or not the names per se, but what those entities, what those beings or the subject matter that the ancient artisans put on the rocks, how they were viewed. What did they represent? What were their activities? What were their energetics? Help me, Jose.
Yes. So, for example, one of the things that we really worked on was the fringe. I don't know if you remember that
yes,
part of the paper.
Yes, of course.
You know, to a person that has no experience in these symbols, you would just see someone depicted in clothing. But the way that my ancestors depicted the symbol of like a loincloth, let's say, it represents so much more. It's not only a representation of a phallus, it's also a representation of the connection of being rooted to the ground. It also represents vibration. It represents the distinction between roles of a man and a woman in that culture.
Let's stop there. Let's take a break, and then we'll get very deep into some more of this vis-a-vis what Jose has helped me to understand with respect to deconstructing the imagery of the Kosos. See you in the flip-flop, gang. Yeah, welcome back, gang. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, and this is a Rock Art Podcast. And we're blessed and honored to have Jose Botello, who's sharing his life and his passion for learning more about the field of anthropology, archaeology, and of course, his ancestry and religious background and language, for that matter. So we were talking about that exercise that I went through to deal with the decolonialization of our work. Maybe give us a thumbnail. What the heck does decolonialization mean?
From my perspective, is really just returning the voice to the native peoples and indigenous peoples that were studied by these anthropologists in the past.
What did they do in the past that they are doing now? What is it that the anthropologists and archaeologists, for that matter, were doing, and how did they view the native people differently?
Our knowledge wasn't really taken seriously. They were more concerned with the stories, the myths, all these rituals.
They didn't give you, they didn't validate you or honor you or acknowledge the value and reality and significance of your heritage, correct?
Exactly, yes.
That was it. And I have to say this, I don't think that things have changed that much, even in California or even in America in general. There's some of us, a few, who are, you know, attempting to integrate the perspective and values and heritage of Native people. But others, I think, have a hard time living in both worlds or sort of integrating, interfingering, as you said, the two domains of knowledge. Please, go ahead.
Yeah, I do believe it's getting better. We're going in the right direction now. There is a lot more Native peoples that are becoming anthropologists now, that are becoming archaeologists now.
Yes, yes.
All these different nations are holding, you know, trainings to, you know, become cultural monitors, to become archaeologists. You know, now all these different forest services, like the control burns, you know, they're going back to these native peoples for all these strategies of conservation. This ecological knowledge that we hold, it's finally being validated.
Yes. No, I agree. We're getting there. I think we have a long ways to go, but we're getting there. I think that with the world of rock art, what I find most difficult is the academic, the scientific side does not understand perhaps the value of that subject or the heritage value or the significance of these images and how much they can tell us, if that makes any sense, Jose.
Yes, exactly, it does. Especially from experience, you know, going to school, growing up, saying, I've always heard, oh, the Nahua people, they never had a written language. Of course we did. That's what our symbols are. That's our language.
I have to jump in here just for a moment. There was a news article on the internet today, just today, that I read that said scientifically they've begun to understand that looking at the Nahuatl material from Tenochtitlan and other areas, it indeed was a language. And they're beginning to be able to even deconstruct and understand a bit about what it communicates and what it was all about. And I think that's fabulous. That's very timely to mention that. Thank you.
A beautiful language. And what these elders have shared with me is that the word Nahuatl translates to harmonious.
Oh.
And there's these other languages that aren't Nahuatl, quote unquote Nahuatl, what these scholars call Nahuatl, which is what the Nahua people speak, which is Masahualtlatoli. Mm-hmm. So these other native languages, like the languages that the Purepecha speak, Mayan, the other groups of the Yaqui, the Wirarica, which that's the name of what people call the Huichol, though all those languages fall under the word Nahuatl because those are harmonious languages.
Oh, okay.
So all those languages in ancient times were called Nahuatl.
And it seems to me that the preservation or the preservation of their religious ideas, their ancient cosmology, in only certain instances has been possible, certainly for the Hopi and for the Huichol, and in some instances for the Nahua. Yes?
Yes, exactly, yeah.
So your mission at this point is to delve more deeply and participate in Nahua culture, ceremony, language, rituals, etc. Am I correct?
Very correct. And it's far more than just a scholarly reason behind that now.
It's your heritage.
It's my heritage. I have a little boy now. I really want him to grow up with a solid foundation and deep roots so he can grow up with these morals, these values that our ancestors shared, because they're beautiful. They teach us how to live in harmony with one another, with all peoples, with nature, with the cosmos.
And how have you been learning about this from your elders? What activities or what particular, you know, elements have you been able to learn? How do you go about learning the Nahuatl language?
Just like our ancestors taught it, just by listening.
By listening.
By listening. Teacher stresses a lot that, you know, he that we shouldn't be taking notes. Our ancestors didn't take notes. We learn by listening to the elders.
Wow.
No, but, you know, but it's understandable now. We live in different times, and we also should take advantage of these technologies that are available to us. So what we do is we study our ancient books, the ones that are left, these codices.
Yeah.
Which in our language, they're called moshtin. We study them, all the symbols. He teaches us chants. He teaches us ceremonial dances. I don't even know how many classes my teacher offers, but me and my fiance, we are in many of them. We gather maybe twice, three times a week. Lives in Oaxaca right now, Mexico. And he studied from a very honorable and famous teacher. His name is Arturo Mesa Gutierrez. And he studied with the Nahua peoples of the northern Mount Sierras of Puebla, Mexico.
Amazing.
And this is where all this knowledge has been passed down.
Now, how long does he stay in the States, or does he have to return to Oaxaca from time to time?
He lives over there. We meet via Zoom now.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So a little bit of digital.
Oh, yes. Yes. And that's just, you know, the traditional ways of my southern lineages that I've been studying. There's also, I have, you know, many amazing teachers and mentors here that are from a few different California native tribes
that
have taken me under their wing. And it's amazing to study both and put them together and just see how similar they are and how much they emphasize to just living in harmony with everything.
Absolutely. Could you share with us in Nahuatl and in English, let's say a particular prayer, perhaps?
Oh, of course.
Thank you.
In Ishpancinco. In panemawani tlokanawake, tlaso kamati, nimislasotla totatsin tonatu, ijuana natsin mesli, tlaso kamati, nimislasotla tlalog ijuan chachutlique, tlaso kamati, tlaso kamachililia, tlaso kamati nawa kampa, tlaso kamati. That prayer, it's more of an expression of gratitude to all the natural and more than natural forces that we are surrounded by. It's a greeting and it's an expression of gratitude to them.
If you were to translate that into English, what would you be saying?
It's thanking. So the word impanemowa, a lot of people translate that as a creator. But the translation that I've learned from my teachers is that which we live for.
Wow.
That is impanemowa. So I can see why people translate it as a creator.
Right.
But from what I've learned and the way I perceive it is, it's just everything, all of existence. So we're thanking that, we're greeting it, we're showing we're expressing our gratitude towards it. We're greeting and thanking Grandfather Sun, Grandmother Moon. We're thanking the celestial waters, the vertical waters, the ones that come from the sky. We're thanking the horizontal waters, the rivers, the lakes, the oceans, the water that we drink. Grandmother Water, we can't survive without her. We express our gratitude to the land. We express the gratitude. We thank it, everything that it provides, all of our food, our homes, all of the essentials that we need to live. And we thank the Nahuacampa, which is the four directions. So we greet and we express gratitude to the four directions of our realm here.
I think that's a good place to end it. I didn't engineer this, Jose. I just moved on it organically, but that is such a supernatural, wonderful way to finish up. Is there anything else you should share before we close? Something that you want to tell the audience of people who will be listening to this?
I want to reiterate the fact that the teachings that these amazing elders, they really put emphasis and stress on using this knowledge to better ourselves and to become people of service. And that is the main goal. That is our purpose, is to be helpful, to be useful to other people. And that's what I want to leave this amazing gathering with you here, is just, you know, when we're studying these ancient symbols, when we're studying these stories, these songs of these ancient peoples, of the ancestors, we just had this veneration, this respect, and this emphasis of just really living in harmony and respecting all walks of life and using what is provided for us to become better people, better relatives.
I have thought about this often, and I would say that the Bible sometimes is our instruction manual for life. And I say, God tells us that the purpose of life, someone says, well, I don't know what the purpose of life is. Says, well, I do. Says, purpose of life is to serve others. Mm-hmm. And that's the primal direction. And if we're doing that, we're doing God's will and God's work. So I think that's fabulous, Jose. And with that, I'll close. See y'all in a few weeks. God bless, and see you on the flip-flop, gang.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.arcpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.arcpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.